Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
Today on the show, or later on the show, we have music journalist Jessica Hopper, which I'm super excited about. But before that, Kim, how are you doing this week?
I'm pretty good this week, and I'm going to tell you why. My hair is really good this week.
Incredible. Why is that?
Well, I have extensions, which I got redone last week, and when we redo my extensions, we also do a relaxer, because I have very frizzy, curly hair, and it gets rid of the frizz. And so it just, like, the extensions are fresh. It's not frizzing when I go outside and it's 85 degrees out. And I find that, like, having good hair is actually, like, really making the whole week go better.
You know, when the hair is easy, everything kind of does follow. I do find that to be the case. It really is. It's a big self-esteem boost when the hair is just going right.
When the hair is going right, I just want to run down the street so as many people as possible can see me with good hair.
I mean, there is also the thing of, like, that you're out in the world again now, and it's like that's starting to really set in for me. I'm like, oh, outfits. Oh, what else can I do? You know, it's like,
yeah,
being seen is kind of cool right now, I feel like.
Yeah, being seen is definitely cool right now. And I mean, the other thing I'm realizing, the boyfriend had a birthday last week, and I had the most impossible time making a reservation anywhere. I finally got a good place, but it's like people are out. People are just out everywhere. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah, people are out. Restaurants are still a little weird. Like, it's still like they're understaffed. The menus are a little weird. Like, everything's a little bit...
True.
Like,
true.
It's not exactly like before. It's a little bit of a... It's a change, you know? It's like a simulation of the past in a way, I find. That's what I've been finding going out, but...
Well, because everybody's just trying to do it the way they kind of remember doing it, you know, given the restrictions that are still in place.
Exactly. But I, just so you know, I have a massive recommendation for our listeners.
Cannot wait.
Which I'm going to write about on the Patreon, because it was, like, so life-changing for me, this movie. So I watched this movie this week, and it was really hard to find. I had to only watch it on, like, the Metrograph website, which is a theater in New York.
Is that true? Yeah.
Okay.
It is.
So, and I had to pay $5 membership to watch it. But anyway, it's called Strangers in Good Company. And it's directed by this woman, Cynthia Scott. It's from 1990. It's a Canadian movie. And it's about, it's a movie that, like, you know, every once in a while you see a movie or you experience a piece of art and you're like, I have never seen anything like this before in my life. And it's like the most exciting surprise. But anyway, the movie is called Strangers in Good Company. And it is about this group of older women. I think the age span is like 65 to 80. And they're on a bus trip and the bus breaks down and they're stranded in the middle of the woods together. And they wind up for 3 days having to become like survivalists together. And they're strangers. And so they wind up telling each other the stories of their lives. And I mean, I could cry, honestly, just even talking about it. It is such a really intimate movie. And all of the women, it's 1990, so it's pre-Botox, pre-fillers. All of the women's faces are like stunning and interesting and lined. Mm-hmm. And there are like some flashbacks, or not in to the film, but flashbacks to pictures of them actually in their lives growing up. Mm-hmm. And it is such a meditation on, you know, the sum of our parts and what we regret and what we hold on to and trauma. And I mean, and not even trauma, like in a depressing way, in this very inspiring an uplifting way about how trauma builds us as people. And I am obsessed with this movie and I want everybody to see it. So it's really one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen about aging. And I really feel like it changed my brain in terms of getting older.
And see, this is the difference between me and you, Romolini, is that yes, you watch this incredibly inspiring, beautiful art house picture.
Yes.
What did I watch in the last week?
What?
The reboot of Gossip Girl. did I not watch it?
I mean, look, that has merit too. I like to keep up. I want to know what's cult. Like, I'm watching also, as we both know, a show about a man and his a young man and his fucked up penis, a rapper.
I know.
They both have value. How's Gossip Girl?
Not great. Not great, but they do let you know who Gossip Girl is. Like that gets revealed in the first episode. It's kind of part of how the show proceeds, that you know who Gossip Girl is.
Oh, interesting.
And it's kind of an interesting, you know, there were a lot of things about it that were like, oh, that was clever. Oh, that was kind of a clever take on like how things have changed since the first Gossip Girl, which I also watched, was on. But it's just, it's not well acted. It's not, it's worth watching if you're like, you took your edible for the evening, you're about to get in bed, and you just want to zone out.
Look, and also, but also, I think it's important to know what's being made. Even if it's like, you know, it doesn't, every moment doesn't have to be the Criterion Collection. You know what I mean? As
that's
we discussed,
true.
Like, it's just like, sometimes you don't want that. But like, I like to know what's happening in the zeitgeist, because I think that it's really easy, so easy to get out of touch quickly. So I'm happy that you're watching Gossip Girl. And, but I also am really psyched that I got to see, because so often I'll watch an art house movie and be like, oh.
Yeah, you know? I know.
When it really speaks to you, and like, but also when you have, at our age, when you find a new foundational piece of art for yourself, mm-hmm, that feels like a miracle to me, whether it's a book, whether it's, you know, a painting, anything.
Yep.
I'm so thrilled to have discovered it, because it's totally such a rare experience. Totally. Anyway,
so here's a thing that's been on my mind a tiny bit.
Tell me.
So I'm in this relationship.
Yes.
With this person who's with me about, you know, two-thirds of the week. And two-thirds of the week, he's either in the city where his children live or he's working in another city. Okay. And so he does a tremendous amount of driving. And so we've worked out a division of labor that's highly gendered. Like,
okay,
he goes, he drives, he's like the hunter. And I'm like the, like, I make the meals, I clean. And it's highly gendered. And I don't mind it. I'm just going to say it. Now, one of the reasons I may not mind it is that I've spent most of my adult life single. So yeah. It kind of has a little bit of novelty to me. But yeah. I am kind of like, I am surprised and not, I'm surprised by this. I'm surprised that it's like, I'm liking this little, you know, scenario.
I think, do you like to drive?
I love driving, but,
okay.
But I think, I mean, he just does it. It's a grind. It's a grind, right. And it's many hours and many drives every week. And, you know, I get it, you know. It seems like an even trade to me. I wouldn't want to do all that driving.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I do all the cooking in my house. And I do all the cooking, and my husband does all of the dishes. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't touch a dish, but I do all of the cooking. And over the pandemic, the cooking, I was really fucking pissed off about the cooking. I was just like, why can't you cook? Why can't you cook one meal? Like, mm-hmm. You need to know more to more than boil pasta. This is ridiculous. But then there was like a couple nights where my husband was away and I had to do the dishes. And I was like, oh, like, no, this balance actually works well. I mean, the truth is, like, everything's kind of annoying in terms of chores. And it doesn't, like, that doesn't seem that gendered to me if he's doing all that stuff and you're doing, like, it doesn't, you know, it becomes out of balance. If it becomes out of balance, you'll know and you'll say, look, you need to clean a toilet.
Yeah. No, it doesn't feel out of balance. It feels equal. And there's other stuff he does too.
Right.
The thing that kind of amazes me is my like delight at it.
Oh, okay. That's what you're talking about. You're actually enjoying it.
I am enjoying being the little woman.
Just cooking and cleaning for one person and not like, you know, not an ungrateful child. Mm-hmm. I actually think can be really nice. Like domesticity can be really nice. I remember having a feeling when I was working a lot and I had more money and I was working constantly and I had really outsourced everything, right? Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this a little bit. I had outsourced cleaning. I had outsourced groceries. I had outsourced even cooking because we would order in all the time. And when I returned to those domestic chores, I was really happy. I found something really satisfying in them. And I can imagine after all these years of being single that there's some satisfaction in the stability of domesticity.
Yeah. I mean, even it feels a different kind of, the domesticity makes the whole relationship feel not just for that reason, but a different kind of stable than other long relationships I've had, you know? I don't mind it. I really don't mind it. But I do think a lot of it is because I have not been doing it for the past 30 years.
Right. It's like it's novel. But you know what? But also that's great then. Because you know what? That stuff can be really grounding. And I do think like it also builds more intimacy when you're just with each other and you're not always racing around to go out. And you know, I think that it... having more of a home life together is a very grounding experience, even if that sounds traditional.
No, it does sound traditional, but some traditional things are okay.
Yeah. I think it's whatever works for you. I think that if you were like, I'm not doing this because this is outside of what I believe of myself as a feminist, I actually think that would be wrong. I think you have to just be in tune with what your needs are in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like it like ruins my feminist cred to be doing this, you know, maybe in the eyes of some, but it doesn't feel that way to me. It does feel like just kind of a nice thing, which I only remark on because it surprised me.
Yes. And and cooking for somebody is amazing. I love that. I love cooking for people.
I mean, you know, I've been cooking for myself for so long. It is so much nicer to like share a meal with somebody. I mean, it's just nicer. And there's something nice also about at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon going like, okay, dinner's on me. How's that going to happen?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's very different to be cooking for a partner and an adult with an adult palate than it is the thankless role of just like family dinner, blah, 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 blah,
Totally. Which sounds like a chore, and you've got to like do the chicken fingers for the kids. And
yeah. And oh, you have to eat the broccoli. Come on, eat the broccoli. Blah, 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 blah. You know, like.
Yeah. No. It's better than that.
Yeah, or like you can't put shit on the broccoli because it's going to be spicy, or if you've added a little cumin and the kid's like, ew, what's this? And you're like, it's cumin.
Or there can't be any green on the plate.
Yeah, no green on the plate. The food can't be, foods can't be touching each other. Like that shit's annoying. Like cooking for somebody who likes to eat and then sharing a meal with them, that's a delight.
It is a delight. So I guess it's really not that remarkable that this is something I'm enjoying.
Well, I'm glad for you. I'm a little bit jealous. I would love to be cooking just for a person who would appreciate my cooking.
Well, I must say, I as much as I'm enjoying this currently, I also, you know, wish I knew what it was like to have a kid to cook for.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say there's lots of shit that you could wish for. I don't know if that's it.
You know, I mean, I have my attitude about not being a mom, which I realize I'm bringing up, you know, this is a huge topic that I'm bringing up in the final moments of our introduction to an episode about something else entirely. But
I love you anyway.
Thank you, honey. But my feelings about not being a mom, like, it's always been a hole. It's always been a hole, and often I felt like that hole was getting bigger as the years marched on. But lately, the past couple of years, I've been like, you know, I would have loved that. I feel sad it didn't happen for me. I'm fine with this.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I can imagine that's a huge thing. I mean, even for me having one, I often have really felt like I wish I had had a second. I wish I, you know, so I can't imagine if I hadn't had them at all. But equally, I was talking to somebody the other day who has decided after like a long and complicated fertility journey to stop trying to have a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to be 42 this year. And we were having this really intense conversation about it. And what she said was, after, you know, a couple tries at IVF and all of these different things, I don't actually know if I want a kid. And I feel weird about that. I feel weird about deciding fully not to, almost as if the ambiguity would make this easier, because I feel like I'm supposed to want a kid.
Right.
But through the process of trying and not being able to, she started looking around and seeing, you know, older mothers and, you know, older parents with an only child, and how complicated that was for the kid and for them. And she said, you know, there's a part of me that feels like I know too much to go into this.
Well, I will tell you something, and maybe it's true of your friend. It's definitely true of me. Because I'm not a mother, mothers, my friends who are mothers, will confess things to me that I don't think they confess to anyone else, because I'm not going to judge them.
I mean, I confess to everybody that motherhood is a scam.
You do. You broadcast it weekly.
I broadcast it weekly. I love my child. Motherhood is still a fucking scam. But anyway, complicated issue, and maybe something we continue to visit, because I think it's an interesting issue for women, and I think it's, you know, it's such a core and fundamental part of who we are, who we are not, you know?
Yep. Absolutely. You know, I think that not being a mother has probably shaped me in as many ways as being a mother shaped my mom, you know?
Totally. I mean, I will say, with the aging thing and having a kid, you are acutely aware of how old you are as your kid gets older. One, because they remind you constantly.
I'm sure.
As they're individuating, I mean, my kid has been like, you can't wear that. What are you doing? That is you're too old to wear that. This has really been a thing with the crop tops lately.
That's hilarious.
But also just the experience of having a kid and just being like, oh, like mine is 11 and... oh, this is about to be their time.
Mm-hmm.
It really is marking time for me in a different way. And I'm individuating from them too and having to say, no, I get to continue to explore younger people's music and younger people's clothes if I want to. And I have to be outside of my child's judgment because the kid will constantly remind you, and I imagine I'm just at the beginning of this and it's only going to get worse, that you are old, that you are their parent, that you are uncool, that, you know, like... Mm-hmm. All Absolutely. Of these things that you're free of if you don't have one, but that's an important part of their identity and becoming who they need to be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, worth thinking about.
Yeah. Well, all worth thinking about. Well, I really like Jessica Hopper. I really liked talking to her. This was interesting. And we went in directions that I was really excited to go in, just in terms of work and Gen X feminism and all of it. It was a cool conversation, I think. So
yep, let's get to it.
Let's get to it. All right. Oh, and don't forget, I just want to say before this, Ashley Ford's book. We are reading it.
Yes.
By the time this comes out, we will be sort of in the last week or so. We're going to be talking to Ashley in early August. So catch up with the book, Somebody's Daughter.
It's great.
It's really great. All right. Let's get into it.
All right. Our guest today is the music critic Jessica Hopper. Jessica has written for Rolling Stone, the New York Times Magazine, and the Village Voice, among other publications, and while still in high school, started the influential fanzine Hit It or Quit It. She also had the very cool job of being the DJ for This American Life, and was the first music editor of the teen girl webzine Rookie, and an editor at MTV News and Pitchfork. Additionally, she's the author of The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic, which just came out in a new, revised, and expanded edition, and is just great. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about your book first, which came out in 2015 and was just reissued in an expanded version. You know, I was thinking, like, obviously with a title like this, you're making a larger cultural statement and planting a flag in the ground. But can you talk about your intention for this book and how it came to be?
Yeah, I had received, you know, interest in doing anthologies of my work earlier on and before I'd ever even put out a book, because in part because I think I was like a... I wrote a lot. I was a columnist for Punk Planet and, you know, had zines and all of this. So even when I was younger, there was still a lot of work out there to potentially be anthologized. But as I got older and, you know, further into my journalism career and had a book or two out, I was still talking to editors and publishers about, you know, I would really like to do an anthology of my criticism. And I kept facing this same bad argument. I mean, it's not even an accurate argument, but just editors saying there was no precedent. There was no precedent. And I would say, well, what about Chuck Klosterman or, you know, Rob Sheffield? Or what about, you know, Ellen Willis's, you know, Out of the Vinyl Deeps, whatever. And they would just say, well, those are different sorts of books, or Ellen Willis is dead, or that was on academic press, or, you know, what Chuck Klosterman does is so different, and this is feminist, and it just doesn't have the same, you know. And I just got a lot of really terrible arguments, mm-hmm. but they all revolved around there's no precedent. And so I just wanted to... You know, initially the title was sort of like a joke with me and my initial editor on the book. And then it became the real title. And it became the real title in part because I just didn't want that same argument to be encountered by anybody who was trying to do something similar, anybody else who was trying to publish feminist music criticism. And I mean, it's you know, the book is not, the title certainly isn't intended as any sort of act of erasure. You know, I mean, there's books going back to, you know, Phil Garland, and her book was in like 1967, 1968, something like that, about R&B. And there is a long history, a long tradition of feminist music criticism. And in some ways, this is book, I really mean it to be a connection between those, you know, historic pioneering works and right now.
Mm-hmm. Did people interpret it as an act of erasure?
I think some people did. Some people, I think, were really pissed about the title, and they were not maybe understanding that the work that the title was trying to do, or I think, you know, but then I've also had, you know, Bob Christgau and Greil Marcus tell me, no, it really is. And these other books, you know, this was more a memoir and this was this. This was not a collection of criticism. And so, you know, I kind of leave the title in the eye of the beholder a bit, because for me, my intent was really to help, as you said, plant a flag, sort of stake some space for anyone who is coming up in my wake or anyone who is trying to do a book that's along these lines, so that there is something that very much demarks precedence.
Yeah, and you know, I think by giving it this title, it's such a big swing. I love how it's a big swing, and I think it actually creates, just like what you just said, it allows people who come after you to make those, it normalizes making a big swing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, it also is just about, you know, the discussion of it. Too, you know, it's like, it's sort of, you know, a lot of my career has been kind of, in the fuck you heroes vein. And so I really too wanted to go like, well, think about all the books that are collections of music criticism by, you know, the canonical men of this world. Be they living or dead, be they Lester Bangs or otherwise, and then how many can you name, how many line your shelves of women or writers of color or people who have, you know, historically been marginalized within this space?
Well, it's such a, I mean, rock criticism is just one of the ultimate white boy venues. And it was that way for an incredibly long time. Like I was about to say, it's kind of amazing that you could title that book what you titled it in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, and it still kind of blows my mind that even though, you know, there's more and more books, particularly within the realm of, you know, music criticism, memoir and biography, within like, you know, music book world by women, you know, it is still dominated by men still, even though I think, you know, the books that women are putting out, particularly in the last couple of years, are just, you know, incredible and incendiary. And a lot of different folks who are coming from historically marginalized perspectives within music criticism, you know, whether it's Hanif Abdurraqib or Sasha Geffen or Jen Pelly, are really making some of the most revolutionary and exciting books within, you know, the last few decades of music criticism. And we see what happens when those folks get published and their books are hugely influential, they're being taught, and maybe most importantly, allow readers and writers to see their own perspective reflected when it comes to criticism and to see things interrogated in ways that they've been wanting to read their whole lives. I mean, that's certainly how I feel reading those folks' books.
Let's talk for a second just about the industry, because you've been writing about music for, according to my calculations, close to 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that wild? I don't feel that
old. Well, it's remarkable that you started at 16. I mean, that's part of your story that I don't know that we appropriately introduced. But you started a fanzine at 16 because you were pissed off about a Babes in Toyland review.
Mm-hmm.
In the Chicago Reader?
No, it was in a local music monthly in Minneapolis, which there was quite a few of, this being, you know, 1990. Yeah, 1990.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. You were in Minneapolis. But that you've been a paid professional writer since you were 16. Have you seen women's roles change? Both, I'm thinking here as artists and also on the business side of things.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things that have stayed the same, some of which I didn't quite notice until I got older, which is that, you know, at some point in my early 30s, I looked around and I was like, why am I one of the oldest people I know doing this? Like, oldest woman I know doing this? And I'm like, 32? You know, like, I looked around and I was like, why aren't there women older than 35 who are like the titans of this thing? You know, why aren't the people who are my heroes from when I was a teenager, you know, my heroines, why aren't they still around, but like the dudes that even preceded them are still here? You know what I mean? So I really sort of paid attention to the landscape of who was in it in more as I got older, which I think is pretty natural. That part hasn't changed. I can name the three or four women working in music criticism who are my same age or older. And you know, the things that have changed, I think, as an industry has certainly been like, while there's fewer gatekeepers, thankfully, there is also less opportunity. There's less paying opportunity. And while mm-hmm. there are more critics of color and young critics from all sorts of different perspectives and backgrounds who are now writing places where they're being widely read, there are significantly fewer opportunities just generally for music criticism. You know, five of the alt weeklies that I wrote for really regularly ceased publication just in the year that I was working on this revised and expanded edition. And in some cases, you know, completely wiped their archives and all of this stuff that is, that's just generally useful in terms of, you know, research, music history, knowing who came before you, building on other people's work, etc. And so there's certainly been great strides forward in terms of broader representation, and a lot of the folks who are coming up in this, in like a younger generation of music criticism, they come with their own canon, and they are really broadening the dialogue in some ways. But also there's just, I think, a lot less opportunity, and I think there's less, I don't want to say respect for music journalism, but just people are not, publications are not really interested in expanding their coverage. Music coverage is oftentimes, you know, one of the first things to go. And
well, because there's no money in it anymore.
Also, yeah. I mean, also, there is a sort of neutering, I feel like, of criticism generally, right? I mean, that's a larger conversation. Yes. But, you know, we're so, that as the separation of church and state and most media companies has been blurred so much, we're so afraid to piss off celebrities in any form, mm-hmm. right? And so criticism's lost so much of its bite. And it's necessary, mm-hmm. right? But, I mean, I don't even know where to find criticism anymore, really, outside of, like, the places, you know, that everybody knows, the New Yorker, the, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the only places where it's managed to kind of stay powerful are places that have that really strong dividing line between editorial interests and everything else that magazines have to do or publications have to do to stay alive. In you know, I mean, this is kind of, I'm sure this is something that you guys remember from your Straight Up Magazine days, is, you know, all that sort of quiet, you know, backdoor quid pro quo, you know, we got to keep such and such publicist happy because their other client is our biggest, you know, our biggest selling cover, and we need them for September, or we need this for that. And it's just a lot of I think over the years, a lot of that sort of horse trading got a lot more, began to sort of dictate so much more of the coverage. I mean, I think it's always been there. And, but I think there was just more leverage and acceptance around criticism. You know, you wanted a record reviewed, you wanted it covered. So people were just like, oh, well, then that's just how it is.
You know, there's also more status too, right? So because like the celebrity needed the publication, right? A little much more than they do now with social media. They needed it to get their message out, right? So now we're in a situation where you're absolutely right. The publication doesn't, what's the leverage, right? Oh, they want to have a photo shoot. I mean, that's about what you get, you know, in terms of their desire to be in a publication. And so then that sort of trickles down and affects everything, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, also, you know, one of the really big differences is like, you know, when I first started even reading music magazines, you know, 15, 16, there were lots of times, you know, major cities would have at least one or two big free local monthly music papers that were about people who were coming through town and new records and, you know, scene reports of all different sorts. And then you also had all weeklies, and then you had people at daily papers who were like, you know, John Fogerty's back and, you know, whatever, covering whatever's happening at like the stadium and local music. And then beyond that, you had sometimes regional magazines, or you had like kind of specialty magazines, you know, that like maybe record store chains, you know, you'd have stuff like Musician Magazine. And then you had national magazines that were more general audience. You had genre magazines. You had things that were very focused on independent music. You know, and the one that survives of that is Alternative Press. But, you know, there were hundreds more music publications when I was even 25.
Right.
And so there's just, along with the broader shrinking of the industry, it's just been long, slow death knell for music criticism. And I think part of that, you know, part of that is, I think, has to do with the sort of patriarchal structure of canonical music criticism, you know, traditional music criticism, that it was very competitive, that it put a huge value on you know, the big national magazines. It did not build an infrastructure because it was competitive. There is not like a any kind of like trade organization, or, you know, like in you know, like poetry magazine kind of situation where it's like, here's a magazine that's just been publishing new poets for 100 years. You know, we don't have something like that in that's really helped sustain things within music journalism. And I think it's just been a huge loss. And so the folks that are coming up now are in a position where it's like they really have to build what they want. And I think and I really hope that that what they're building is much more sustainable and much more community minded, because I think that could allow criticism a new future. And maybe the old criticism, the criticism that I came up with, maybe it does need to die. And maybe that's how it lives.
There is something about the criticism that I came up with that felt like it was such a little circle jerk of guys, always guys, making obscure references and referring to like some guy who appeared on the Colgate Jazz Hour who none of us have heard of, and one-upping one another. And it wasn't for the fan, really. No. It wasn't for the fan at all. I felt very much as though it was for each other.
Yeah, and that's very much what I came up with. And the folks who were, you know, the exceptions to that rule, you know, Terry Sutton at City Pages, Ann Powers, Greg Tate, you know, a couple people that I read early on where they were really speaking a language that was much more rooted in enthusiasm. And then, you know, like, you know, as an extension of their fandom, but then also the other part of it was that they were speaking to the broader audience. They were speaking to the uninitiated. Sometimes I think about how earlier music criticism in a weird way was like, it always felt like you had to be studying for like the pop quiz, you know, that it was like preparing yourself for, you know, for me as like a young feminist critic, for, you know, basically I had to constantly prove myself. And I think, you know, that's young folks in a lot of different industries, you know, but part of it was like, at some point I became very much like, oh, this is a trap. I am deeply disinterested in this. This is a huge distraction that keeps me from doing the work that's most valuable, I think, to my music, to the communities I was part of, to my readership, you know. I don't want to be part of the circle jerk. And I never have. I never thought that was cool. You know, no. I wanted everybody to feel like they could come into music, and that's part of my, you know, mission as a writer.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot about, you know, Gen X feminism and men being the gatekeepers, and how those dudes were in music journalism or anything else, but since we're talking about music journalism, since those dudes were like a way in, and I think about women I know who got jobs in the 90s, early aughts because of their famous boyfriends, or, you know, they would literally do like a sidebar of their husband's, you know, feature, but just to get the byline, because a byline's a byline.
Mm-hmm. Can I interrupt for 1 minute to tell you that the reason why I ever wrote for Spin was because I was living with a rock critic who would only write for the LA Weekly or the Village Voice. And the editor from Craig Marks from Spin called and was like, I picked up the phone. He called at home and Craig was like, "Hi, Kim, I really want you to write for Spin. Can you get Charles to write for Spin?" It was like, he sort of trolled this opportunity for me because what he really wanted to get to was my boyfriend.
Yeah, no. And I think that and I'm sorry that happened to you, but I think that we had to fight so much with men. I mean, and I know this goes across industries because we were kind of pitted against each other. There were so few opportunities for us. And I, you know, it felt so cliquey and exclusionary in so many ways. And I don't know that we did enough then. I don't know if we could, but I think back and I wonder if we did enough, because we had to play their game a little bit, if we did enough to be more inclusive. And it was a failure in some ways of Gen X feminism, that like that was our way in, was through dudes, you know?
Well, also, I think, I mean, that's a lot of that is just, you know, the internalizing of the patriarchy, which right. I don't want to say like you can't be blamed for, but I mean, yes, part of it was failure of feminism. You know, second wave feminism was so focused on jobs and material freedom.
Yep.
You know, and that certain things got left behind, you know, particularly if you are working in a predominantly white space, you know, male dominated space, space with patriarchal hierarchies, that it just made you so laser focused on getting it right, being twice as good as men, being, you know, it kept us so oriented in like, how can I continually like game this system,
yes,
so that I can just live,
yes,
so that I can just benefit from it. And you know, I write about that some in my afterword for the new edition of the first collection.
Yes.
And even though I am several years removed from having like an active byline and actively pitching editors every month. I was still afraid to call that out. But, you know, the thing that I find is that, you know, that entire system that I came up in as a professional freelancer, it really taught you, whatever you do, don't betray the powerful men. Don't betray whiteness. Don't betray this hierarchy. Because you will get punished. And you saw it happen all the time.
Yep.
You know, you saw people that didn't have careers anymore. You know, you saw the women that could, you know, stomach sitting on, you know, the editor's lap, famously, if we're talking about Spin, to, you know, Bob Guccione. And it was Bob Guccione Jr.'s famously having interns sit on his lap. You know, and then all of a sudden they had a byline.
Yep.
And they had a byline that maybe you were covetous of. You know, and it certainly it wasn't limited to journalism, though I know that is where our Venn diagram overlaps. You know, in doing the oral history of the Lilith Fair, which isn't something that's in this book. If I'd put it in this book, it would have made the book like 100 pages longer. So maybe it's its own book at a different time. But, you know, talking to Sarah McLachlan about, you know, some of the things that were presaging, bringing things to a head before they put together Lilith, and her talking about going to, you know, even though she had a gold record or whatnot, really on the come up, Sarah McLachlan, you know, going to a radio station to do promo, and the programming director kind of taking her to the side and going, yeah, thank you for coming to visit. We love the record. But, you know, we already have Lisa Loeb in rotation.
Oh, God.
Or, you know, Amy Mann told this story about doing all these demos for A&M and whatnot. And, you know, Amy Mann, hardly a slouch, Amy Mann, one of our great living songwriters, bringing these demos in, and the label saying, you know, these are great, but we've already just signed a woman singer-songwriter, and it was Sheryl Crow. And right. So, you know, to me, when I look back at old issues of Spin or Rolling Stone or whatever I'm coming across in my research for my other book, particularly, you know, it's so rare to see a woman's name. And then invariably when I do, I write it down and then I go Google her up, and then, you know, it's somebody frequently who had, you know, maybe a couple one-off bylines, and then they went into PR, or then they went into marketing.
Right.
But the men that they were writing alongside are people who are still working in music criticism. And so I am, you know, a little bit less interested in putting, you know, the failure on second wave feminism to be more inclusive. I mean, that's sort of a given. Feminism also forever struggles to be more inclusive, but put it on a system that was not built or designed to benefit anyone other than those men. Because if it could have been otherwise, it would have been otherwise. We would see a different shape of music journalism these days.
Yeah. No, it's I mean, just talking about aging in the music industry, both as a critic and an artist, I think of the music business as such a young person's game. But when I really think about it, I'm mostly thinking about women being shut out after a certain age, not men. It's, you know, like really, like I was thinking about, we were going to talk about this, and I was thinking, let's talk about aging, because like even Kim and I were talking about Madonna aging, which is a little bit off topic, but like, I don't know, Kim, you want to talk about Madonna a little bit?
Well, no, I just feel like I saw, you know, more power to her, but when I saw that photograph of her on performing at Pride and she was wearing like a lederhosen and she was topless, I thought to myself, this is not how 25-year-old me thought Madonna was going to age. She was such a disruptor. She was such a rebel. She could have done such interesting things with her career, and she seemed like a curious and interesting person. And instead, she hasn't been able to grow out of this image of herself as a sex thing. And it just bums me out.
But do you think the world would be interested in Madonna as a non-sex thing? Is the world of pop genuinely ready for like straight up menopausal, postmenopausal Madonna and all that, that, you know, might figure?
Menopausal rock. Know? I'm ready for it, but I don't know.
I mean, I'm ready for it, but I don't, you know, I think, you know, I do think things have changed a little bit in the last couple, maybe last decade, in terms of there being more audience loyalty around women who are, you know, aging artists, whether it's, you know, Lucinda Williams or the continual sort of, I don't want to say revivification, but like, it seems like every couple of years, people are like, oh my God, Stevie Nicks, you know, or Kate Bush, which obviously I think they're, you know, really iconic. Their iconic status continually fueled by Tumblr and now Instagram, you know, and people, I mean, these women are 70, late 60s, you know, how old is Stevie? I don't know.
Right.
But that, or, you know, Joni, obviously she's in her mid 70s at this point. You know, that I think in part we see that changing a little bit because younger music fans, I think it's more, and I kind of chalk this up to not just the internet, but Tumblr, people being more naturally curious and naturally interrogating the narratives around women in music, around Black pioneers, around queer and trans pioneers, and just being like, they just assume that those folks have been erased. Like, they kind of come into fandom knowing that it's always been, you know, music journalism has always been, and music culture even, been interested in erasing those people's stories. So those folks have, you know, been, they're just more naturally interested in interrogating that and then also excavating those people. And so I think it's given particularly some of these women a greater longitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are certainly 18,000 articles about the 50th anniversary of Blue, and I didn't think that was a bad thing.
Yeah, I wrote some of them.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, and Joni herself, I write about this in the book that I'm working on now, about women in music in 1975. You know, Joni goes to kind of turn towards jazz in part because, you know, she's amid the real Laurel Canyon beau monde, so to speak. And her buddies, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and you know, the poker night she regularly attends that's hosted by Don Henley. You know, she's really around all of these dudes who are rock stars and who she's ostensibly peers with. And the men are getting older, and the women in the room are forever getting younger. And she looks around and she realizes that at 35, she's the oldest woman in any room that she's in. Okay. If there's even another woman there.
Jesus.
Right? And so you're Joni Mitchell at the height of your powers. And so she said she started looking around outside of rock, which is still then fairly young as a genre. Mm-hmm. We're talking 1973, 74 here. She's looking around and going, well, where's a space where women can get older? Where women can be older geniuses, and she sees jazz as a place where women are you know, allowed that. They're allowed to age. They're allowed to be just around. They're allowed to be iconic. They're allowed to get to 60. They're, you know,
yeah,
and still perform. Mm-hmm. And so she turns to jazz, and you know, she's maligned for it, and people call her a dilettante and all of this, but she was also just starting to really get like kind of get to the acceptance of her own genius. She was really at the height of her powers, and she was really starting to realize that, you know, the synthesis of her work as a producer of her own work, as a vocalist, as a player, you know, that she could get anybody she wanted to be on her records, and, you know, as a band leader, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And she's like, finally, I got it. I can do it. And then she's looking around going like, they're not going to be into this around here. You know, this is, again, one of these situations where it's like you look around here and people are, you're maybe seeing there's not a lot of precedent for what you're doing. And you're like, I just want to be my best self. I just want to deliver my best work. I finally feel free enough to do it. I feel like I've untangled myself from all the games or the lies or the hierarchies I had to come up with. I mean, that's part of the reason I wanted to write about Joni, because I identified with that. But also, I just thought that was really powerful.
How do you engage with music these days? How do you find new music to listen to?
I have a little notebook where I keep a running list of things that I want to listen to. Normally from whether I'm reading artist interviews or it's on Instagram or something comes up. Sometimes if I'm listening to like just the terrestrial radio, I listen to college radio a lot whenever I'm driving. I've had long stretches where I've kind of had to give up on the news. And also when there's kids in the car who are sensitive creatures, I'm not trying to raise my kids in a bubble, but they get upset and they're like, who got murdered? So we listen to the college radio a lot.
Right.
I just keep this running list. And then whenever I have time where I feel like I'm open, you know, like when I'm driving or I'm cleaning or I'm cooking, that's when I put stuff on. Fortunately, because I am not maniacally trying to freelance in every direction, I don't have to spend my days trying to like keep up with right now. And so this has actually allowed me, I would say, to be in greater relationship with music in a way that is much more akin to kind of how I came into it. It's my slower early 90s pace, where it's like, I gotta wait for the music to come out and then I check it out, or I see what my friend says, or it allows me to rely more on word of mouth, and I'm interested in that. I like how that feels. It puts me in a deeper relationship with music.
And now let's take a quick break for some ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And we're back.
This is kind of a fuzzy question, but, you know, I look at my playlists and I see so many songs that are just somehow suddenly 25 years ago, you know, and I'm so interested in hearing new music, but I don't know where to begin to search for new music.
You know, the other thing, too, I think a great way to is there are some really good newsletters, you know, I'm into kind of more esoteric music than maybe most people. And I like, you know, stuff like Tone Glow, which is a really good newsletter. But, you know, 80% of the young music writers that I follow on Twitter, which I really try to stay off of most days, have newsletters. And sometimes I just kind of sometimes I keep up on them, sometimes I don't. But that it allows me to access that at like a slower pace and something that's not on social media. And again, just keeping like this list of stuff that I can go find. But yeah, I mean, I too am like, wow, am I still listening? Like, I'm still listening to the Cocteau Twins, Heaven or Las Vegas with the same frequency I always have been going on year 30, you know, watching Miley Cyrus cover Heaven in Las Vegas last week at the opening of her Vegas residency and apologizing to her audience for it being kind of inaccessible to them.
I kind of love Miley Cyrus.
I think Miley remains interesting in the ways that she confounds. But I think in this way, I think of her much more like, though not as gifted in some ways, like Linda Ronstadt. Linda Ronstadt did not sing her own material. She was known as like a tremendous song stylist and that she knew exactly what would suit her voice, what were the right songs for her. And I think Miley is like that. Miley's covers are incredible, in part because it's like she has really good material, but that also she's a good song stylist, but she's also a really good mimic. That's kind of what I like most about her.
I want to change directions a little bit because I want to make sure that we just talk about some things about getting older too, just because that's sort of the lens through which we examine everything here. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about anger a lot. And, you know, you start the new editions forward with, when I was 15, I was furious about the world. And I wonder if you're still angry. How do you deal with anger now? Like, how have some of these issues sort of played out in a way, especially the anger?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And, you know, sometimes I think about this, I think it was a Jen Pelly tweet from like mid-corona time, where she talked about how, something about how with everything going on and amid, you know, amid COVID and quarantine, she found herself returning to who she was at 19, which was, you know, the punk kid forever at the back of the show at like the anarchist book table, like just furiously like trying to find things that will being that young, returning to being that young
yes.
punk person.
Yep.
And I feel like that has been maybe in some ways the last couple years for me. You know, I think like a lot of people, maybe more acutely so during this quarantine time and all that has unfolded in the last half decade in America and before then, just getting back in touch with how I rate those things make me. And I feel good about that.
Yeah.
I feel really good about that. And I feel like, rage has brought me back to a certain level of awareness, about, I don't know, everything.
Yeah.
I mean, this sounds really vague, but just, I think that only as I've gotten older, I've learned to find ways to not be consumed by the rage, but rather propelled by the rage. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't feel like the hot lava rock sitting on top of my heart. And granted, certainly there's still those days, and there's, you know, injustices in America and beyond that, that bring the lava rock front and center. Yeah. And just weight, you know, the weight on your chest. But as I've gotten older, I've done a lot of different things to try to recover from the more corrosive forms of anger, mm-hmm. to appreciate them for what they bring me, to not continually replay the tapes in my head that animate it at inappropriate times. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like being stuck in these old spaces, like old corrosive rage. The primary way that I've dealt with that is, you know, various forms of recovery and therapy and finding community, but also meditation, which I resisted for a really, really long time, but is now a very necessary part of my day. And also not trying to just silo that rage off, to really see it and hold it and admit it and all the things that we're supposed to do is, you know, to observe it rather than be absolutely consumed.
I was just going to say observe it rather than reacting to it is like the mm-hmm. biggest change. It's, and I don't know if this is your experience, but there was a long time in the middle of, from being that young, angry person to being a woman in my 40s and whatever that means, that I had a very complicated relationship with not only anger, but all of my, you know, depth of emotion. And I was so reactive, and then I was trying to stuff down that reaction, right? So neither mm-hmm. of those things were super healthy. And I do think the gift of your 40s, if you can be here and be present with yourself, is observing those things in yourself, but not having them take over anymore, because there's a more of a presence in who you are. And I feel very lucky to be in my 40s, to be honest, and just
you couldn't pay me. Yeah. You couldn't pay me money. I've sometimes joked with my two good girlfriends, like, how much, I'll ask this to you guys, how much would you have to get paid, like, as like a 1 year salary to go be 24 again?
Infinity.
Wow. To like live in that for a year as a salary? I don't know. I mean, the only thing you'd think is maybe it would be like an amazing, like it would be like wife swap or something, like an amazing experience where you could kind of like go in and like fix some things, like a Back to the Future. But no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I would like to go back to my 24-year-old self and be like, oh yeah, I'm all right. Like, you know, I'm no idiot. I'm not ugly.
I would like go back to my 20s, and I wouldn't try to have like serious relationships.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, period. I don't know what business I had doing that. But like, sometimes when I think about, you know, it's like, just from a round number perspective, I think maybe like low millions, frankly. You know, like, it's like, I mean, like, like 2, 3, 2, 5, like something that then I could transport back and like be like, all right, I'm going to buy like a mansion in the woods, and I'm going to endow, you know, some organization.
Right. Yes.
And I'm going to like the payoff would have to be really significant. In part because I don't want to be that dumb to the world again.
Oh God.
And that's, and like, that's the
like,
thing.
The dumbness of my 24-year-old self in part was, as you're saying, John, because I was really cut off from accessing certain emotions. I was like constantly invalidating myself because also it didn't, you know, the world generally and the people that I was around at 24 were not interested in me being my full self.
Yes.
At 24. And so you just really, I think, you learn to silo what doesn't serve you. And I was just pushing down a constant sort of simmering rage because I thought the problem was me rather than like, no, this is a perfectly normal reaction for everything that you're going through and everything that you've been through. And very fortunately, in my mid-20s, I found a wonderful therapist who's a Buddhist nun. And then she really taught me a thing or two. So, and that was like kind of the first time that I was able to even just get beyond my own flailing perspective, you know.
Totally. And the ways in which I was driven by shame and was driven by jealousy and was like no sense of what was right for me, just always the external reach, you mm-hmm. know.
Mm-hmm.
And just and when you were talking earlier about like having to be the best and playing those games career-wise, you know, just like mm-hmm. the shit that I bought into and the ways I contorted myself in order to go after prizes that I didn't even know if I really wanted, and I certainly in retrospect realize I did not. It's mm-hmm. it's yeah, I don't know, 10 million I think, honestly. I think
yeah. You know, I feel like that awareness is really a big part of my, you know, very early 40s was realizing all, you know, really I would say mourning, that there was a kind of mourning for a few years of all the ways that I had, as you said, contorted yourself. I, you know, for me, it was really, I've made myself very small.
Yeah.
Very small, just so I could be in the room with certain men, whether it was my boyfriend or it was a man who was going to help my career or whatever. Don't emasculate him by being as smart as I naturally am.
Oh, God.
Right?
Yes.
Right? And so then, you know, for me, it was kind of, I really started to have that awakening while I was at Pitchfork. I was the first woman hired in at a senior level and not brought up from, you know, being an intern there. I was hired at a senior level, first woman there in 19 years, you know, since they were founded. And I was 38 and real like, you know, if you've never hired a senior, you know, a senior woman before, and I'm your first senior woman, it's pretty intense,
yeah.
Girl. But you know, around that time, I think I really started to have, that awareness of, okay, well, I have the thing that like, you know, supposedly I was working up to this whole time. I'm here. I don't want it. I'm building, you know, with my blood, sweat, and tears, something that does not actually benefit me, does not sustain other people.
Mm-hmm.
It sustains a system that is the whole problem, you know? And then there was this in my early 40s, just really kind of a mourning for all these things that I had believed, all of these things that I went along with, even though I didn't believe them, kind of a mourning for that lost time and even lost energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming out of the other side of processing that is a new and different liberated energy where I'm not really interested in doing something that doesn't feel good, build something beautiful, benefit people who need it, isn't genuinely useful to a world that I want to be part of building. And in that, the further liberation is the power to say no, or not even write back to people's idiot emails, not correct people, not whatever. I just feel over it. And I also just have a really different sense of value about my time, my energy, and what's important, because I gave so much of that away for so long, even as I was doing, you know, ostensibly feminist work and building my career. And I just really want something different. And maybe that is like, you know, you read books, but it's like postmenopausal women being like, I don't give a shit, you know? And I really feel like that's the big gift of being, in my 40s and being in that place, is like all the things I did to like try to be cute, because if I was cute enough to somebody, they might hire me, or they might not consider me so intimidating.
Oh, yes.
All this shit.
Oh.
You know, I like, and it's like, not to be like, and I just wear muumuus and be cute for me, but that's, you know, it's the pandemic gift in itself. But like, to just not believe that anymore, to not think that was an okay use of my time.
To not be consumed in that same way. I don't ever want to be, I don't give a shit. That's the one thing I'm like, don't look at me. Like, I don't want, like, it's the best, it's the most relieving thing to be like, don't look at me. I don't want to fucking, I don't want my value tied up in my looks anymore. It's over. That was such a painful thing to have to go through, the preening and the, just all of it. And I think about the relationships I missed out on with women because I was busy focusing on the men who had the power, and you know, in the or the sexual relationship or whatever,
or competing with the other women.
I feel so sad about that. If you want to talk about grief, I feel like I missed out on knowing women throughout my life because I was distracted with the game that I was a part of.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there was very few women. There was very few women in the world that I was in. But just in the last couple of years, there were some women who I've always thought were so, so cool, who were kind of on the periphery of either my social or professional world, who were about the same age. And, you know, in the sort of moments of mourning and clarity that came after, I've befriended a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've even talked about the things that some of, you know, and this is, I'm talking about like when we were like 25,
right,
that the men in our world would tell us about each other, the way that they would, that these other women would get talked about, particularly women who were really maybe a little bit further ahead of me and like not giving a shit.
Yep.
And us kind of comparing notes later on, being like, oh yeah, and he always said da 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 about you, and so I just thought you hated me, or I thought
yes,
whatever. And then we're like, well, they did this, and you're like, oh my god, this whole fucking thing is just a plot. This was a plot to keep us from comparing notes,
yeah,
and kicking these motherfuckers out of the scene.
Yep,
you know, 86ing their bands or their whatever from what we were doing, or from, God forbid, what could we have done if we had, like, you know, formed a kind of like a Voltron, you know, or like, what is it like in Transformers,
yeah,
like where we all go together to make one supercar?
Yeah, yeah.
We would have run them over.
I know.
You know?
I know.
And so, and so I just, it's like, I really, I would like to maybe take like a, you know, I think this is less the case these days. But I think it's still pervasive. Like, I feel like there should be like a sort of almost like decision tree that we like post up in like the venue bathroom. It's like we paste it up. That's like, is a man telling you not to talk to this other lady because she is crazy,
right?
Or because she doesn't like you, but you think what she's doing is cool, or you think she looks cool, or whatever. Like, if yes, then call her. You know, I just am so curious about what, and I know not everybody is like that. I mean, I think I was well groomed in wanting to have a certain amount of power in these scenes too, because I wanted the freedom to do what I wanted to do and didn't fully realize like, oh, I can build this myself. And I did build it myself,
right,
in different ways over time. But I think that's the liberation of now. I'm building it now. I started a production company with my sister after my sister was the former publisher of Rookie for 7 years, and we started a production company, and you know, I say no to anything that I feel less than like super enthusiastic about. You know, I let go of so much of the should about all of this. Yeah. And and in that way I feel like I'm back to my 19-year-old self, and the all the fuck you, I may have different wisdom, I hopefully have some,
right,
but I feel like I am back and like in partnership with her in a way.
Right. Well, yeah. Connecting to that spirit, I feel like connecting to that spirit plus wisdom is really the best we get at this age, that younger mm-hmm. spirit. But anyway, Kim, sorry I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say that felt like a really lovely spot to end on. But before we do, I want to ask you what the three albums that you turn to repeatedly are.
Ooh, well, Cocteau Twins, Heaven in Las Vegas. Heaven or Las Vegas? Heaven and Las Vegas? Jesus, what is it? my memory is terrible. Welcome to my age. The records I turn to are in forever time, not just in pandemic time, because during pandemic time, I've been listening to a lot of this great record called Wind Chimes in the Australian Outback. And it's just the sound of like animals I don't know and like these beautifully mic'd wind chimes. Highly recommend. It's there on Spotify. Mm-hmm. I find it, it's extremely mellow. Because there's times I couldn't even handle music. But like my all-timers are Cocteau Twins, Heaven or Las Vegas, Joni Mitchell, Hissing of Summer Lawns, and God, can I pick a LaBelle record?
Yes.
I'm trying to narrow it down. Now I'm just like looking at my shelves like I've never heard music before.
No, this is what always happens to me when somebody asks me to list everything. And I realize asking you to list this is very male of me.
No, it's not. It's not. And the other thing that I've been listening to right now a lot is the new His Golden Messenger record, because I have a real dad rock penchant too. I have a real dad rock streak.
I have a real like I'm on the Wilco Steely Dan nexus a lot lately, and I like dad rock. I'm somewhere in between. Like if dad rock and yacht rock had a baby, that would be my taste in music lately.
That's like my permanent wheelhouse. I really well. Then I have to recommend to you that you get into this His Golden Messenger record. We got to keep you away from like getting into like Steve Winwood and Dire Straits, like really taking a turn.
That was, unfortunately, that was 16-year-old me.
Okay.
Because I can't say I didn't listen to a lot of Traffic as a teenager.
Oh God. That's a bridge too far for me.
I know. what can I say? Never would have admitted that when I wrote about music.
Well, now we know the real truth.
Yes.
Jessica, where can people find you so that they can find your book, find everything about you?
I hope they can't find everything about me. Good God. You can find me generally at jessicahopper.org, because jessicahopper.com is the stripper Jessica Hopper. We are different.
Who follows me on Instagram?
Yeah, she's like a maybe not stripper, but she's like a pole dancing famous person. She was in the Red Shoe Diaries. She was briefly an actress.
Good for her.
She's done Playboy. I know all about her.
I was actually excited because I was like, oh, Jessica Hopper follows me. That's cool. And it was the pole dancing lady. It wasn't you at all.
Yeah, so I'm .org. People can also find my books through, you know, bookstores generally now, you know, but through I always recommend people order from Women and Children First, which is my local feminist bookstore, one of the last 8 feminist bookstores in America. And people can also subscribe to my newsletter while they're on my website, which I update sometimes every couple weeks, sometimes every year. It's been really hit or miss. So, you know, it's there. It's there. Thank you for having me on your pod, which I love to listen to so much because I love to listen to women who are my same age talk about anything.
Aw, thanks, Jessica.
This is so good.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, y'all.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Everything Is Fine. We are your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it on all the platforms. That really helps people find us. You can also find bonus episodes and bonus material for the show on our Patreon at patreon.com/everythingisfine. We're on Instagram at EIF Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. And you can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.